This election is so crazy that stories are being made up front, right, left, and center.
This anchor app user, Jesse. Today, the Washington Post fact checker and PolitiFact Illinois joins us to help you make sense of all the claims that have made this election, whether it's the presidential race or the Illinois Safe Roads Amendment. On Friday's program, we heard from a former Champaign County voter who said she felt singled out as the only person of color and the only person asked to present her photo ID by an election judge she says was wearing a campaign shirt for GOP candidates.
Not only are election judges not allowed to wear t-shirts showing which candidates they support, voters are not, poll watchers are not. So that makes me sort of wonder about the veracity of the entire story. If she was viewed suspiciously in her polling place, I'm obviously terribly sorry she felt that way, but I'm wondering how much embellishment there is.
That was Champaign County Clerk Gordy Holton on Friday. We'll follow up today with a nonpartisan voting rights lawyer. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I hope everyone enjoyed their last weekend before this presidential election. We know the fact checkers have been very busy this election season. There's been so much discussion about truth, lies, all the claims that are being made by politicians. For much of this hour, we're going to be looking at the biggest claims and the facts behind them. We're taking your questions on what issues on the ballot are confusing you. We've been talking to listeners about this on social media all weekend. We've got questions from Reddit and Facebook that we're going to be addressing, particularly about Illinois issues. Later on in the hour with PolitiFact Illinois and Illinois Public Radio's Springfield Bureau Chief Amanda Vinicky. For those of you who are listening right now, if you want to tweet or call us, we've got lots of questions about the Safe Roads Amendment on the ballot. We're going to get to that later in the hour, but we're going to start with national politics and the national scene. Again, as we're talking, if you have any questions, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show, 21st Show. We wanted to start on the national scene with the Washington Post and reporter Michelle Lee. She's part of the fact checker team that's been working overtime on fact checking the biggest statements made by our presidential candidates. She joins us now from the Washington Post newsroom. Hi, Michelle. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Michelle, I wanted to ask you, first of all, about how do you even know how many claims you guys have checked on the team in this past couple of months?
Well, I can tell you that we fact checked 400 claims over 25 debates, but I haven't actually added up how many we've fact-checked, you know, the entire campaign, which we've been fact-checking for 22 months, I realized.
Wow. And can you explain, we had a comment on Facebook about someone who said, I don't know if I trust the Washington Post fact-checker. What's the process that you all go through to fact-check claims?
Sure. So we pick claims based on how newsworthy they are and whether it gives us a chance to explore some type of a policy issue, like an underlying policy issue, whether it's domestic or foreign. So we pick claims based on those criteria. It doesn't matter whether they're a Democrat, Republican, Libertarian. We'll fact check them all. Usually throughout the year, it turns out that, you know, Democrats and Republicans will end up fact-checking both of them about equally. This presidential campaign, it's been unbalanced because throughout the primaries especially, there were so many more Republican candidates than there were on the Democrat side. And also during the general, Donald Trump has tended to be, you know, more likely to say falsehoods than Hillary Clinton has. So it's been a bit unbalanced, but we approach everything with the same type of transparency and consistency that we strive for.
And how do you do this? You use Pinocchios. I know lots of people do different fact checkers. Does you have a Pinocchio rating system for your fact checks?
We do. It's a 1-4 Pinocchio system, and you can think of 1 as like mostly true, 2 as half true, 3 as mostly false, and 4 as false. And every once in a while, we'll give out the Geppetto check mark, which is what we call for something that's completely true. And we don't use that very often. We tend to focus on things that are not true. But every once in a while, there will be something that is either sounds too good to be true or it's just unbelievable, but it turns out to be true, then we'll award the Geppetto check mark. But usually we rate them on a Pinocchio scale.
And speaking with Michelle Lee from The Washington Post, she's on the line with us from D.C. We're talking about their fact-checking. We're going to get into First National claims, then we're going to be talking about Illinois claims in particular later on in the hour. For those of you who have not yet voted, we've seen some record early voting turnout, but we know lots of folks are still headed to the polls tomorrow. So we want to make sure you have all the right information. If you have questions, you can give us a call, 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. By the way, if you follow our Twitter handle, that's 21STShow, we do tweet out a lot of the things that we're talking about, and we're sending out right now Michelle and the team's articles that they have been sending out the past couple of days. In particular, you guys have really ramped up. You had something, and Michelle, I wanted to start with that. Now that we've established the Pinocchio system, some of the claims that you all this morning you all put out, kind of the final arguments that Republican candidate Donald Trump, Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton have been making this past weekend. And you guys on Friday also put out a list of the biggest ones, and I want to get to that. But let's start with some of the biggest claims that Donald Trump has made. And I wanted to ask this first one about voting, just because we are talking about voting. And he has a claim where he says, let's do this. We've heard a lot of these statements over the time. This is Donald Trump. Let's do this. Let's not worry about it. Let's get out and vote by the millions, and we won't have to worry about what's taking place behind the scene. Remember this, 1.8 million people that are dead are registered to vote. You know, they talk about that's a threat to democracy, what I'm saying. 1.8 million people, 2.75 million people are registered to vote in two states. What is that a reference to, Michelle?
So Trump has talked about this very often, as you know. You know, he said that there's a widespread voter fraud and we all have to look out for it. Who knows what's going on behind the scenes? And he's been using these numbers, the 1.8 million people who are deceased and registered still on the voter rolls, and then 2.75 million people who are registered to vote in two states. And what he's referring to is the findings of a 2012 Pew Research Center study. Actually, it's the Pew Charitable Trust, but it's a study on how the election system can become more accurate, more cost-effective, and more efficient. And as a part of the study, Pew found that there were, you know, kind of documentation issues within the election system. A lot of states were behind in upgrading to the latest technologies because they had government restraints on budgets. And as a result of those types of challenges for state and local governments, they had inefficiencies within their records, within their voting rolls. And one of the things that the study found was that there were 1.8 million records for people who were already dead but whose registrations were still on the voter rolls. And then about 2.75 million people registered to vote in more than one state, which it can happen if you're registered in one state and then you move to another state and you register there, but then you don't tell your old state that you had moved. So these things happen. But the thing is that this study didn't confirm any sort of fraud, any widespread or isolated instance of fraud. So Trump is using this data to make a claim that's not true. And this use of data like this, we've awarded four Pinocchios because it's false.
Okay, so but this is an interesting thing because people might say, but what he's saying is true because there are 1.8 million people on record who were deceased but whose voter registration still exists. But I guess the reason you're saying that's not true is because you're saying we don't know that people voted on behalf of these dead people.
Right. We try to take a look at the claim in its entirety, so how he is using the data. And the way he's been using this data is to make claims of voter fraud, make claims that something questionable is happening behind the scenes, as he said in the quote that you read. And the connection between the two is just not there. And the study didn't confirm that. And voter fraud actually is a very rare thing to happen, and it does happen. It's not to say that it doesn't, but this data just doesn't support the point that he is making.
That's a claim by Donald Trump. Let's go to a statement by presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. This is a statement she made. I noticed there's sort of a pattern. Most of the statements that you all were fact checking for her are statements about Donald Trump. So,
she likes to just quote things that Donald Trump said, and because he tends to make statements that get a lot of news coverage, she just quotes him, and that's been her strategy, which makes it difficult for us as fact checkers, because if she's just reading direct quotes from Donald Trump, then it, you know, all we can say is whether she's taking them out of context or whether she's correctly quoting him. So.
And so here's one, and I think we've all heard Secretary Clinton say this. I'm running against a man who says he doesn't understand why we can't use nuclear weapons. He actually said that, then why are we making them? And he wants more countries to have nuclear weapons, Japan, South Korea, even Saudi Arabia. When he was asked who he consults on foreign policy, Donald Trump says he didn't need to consult because, and I quote, I have a very good brain. He says he knows more about ISIS than our generals do. What's the Pinocchio rating on that statement?
So I don't think we specifically rated this claim before. In our roundup today, we wrote about claims that we previously rated and then also wrote about claims that we haven't rated. Just wanted to cover a lot of the claims that they both have been saying in recent days. And Trump did say the things that Clinton says he did. So he did say, quote, I have a very good brain, and that he's speaking with himself on foreign policy. He has said that he knows more about ISIS than the generals do, and that's a direct quote. In terms of nuclear weapons, he has said that, you know, more countries should be armed with them, you know, to protect themselves. But then he's also said that he would use nuclear as a last resort. So these are things he has said, although we will point out that, you know, these are usually things he said maybe once or maybe twice, kind of isolated instances. So, you know, take that for what that could mean to you as a voter. But in terms of whether he did say it, these are actual statements that he has made.
Okay. Now let's go to Michelle. We've got about 5 minutes left, and I want to go to what you guys put out on Friday, which is sort of the biggest claims that have been made. It's kind of your roundup of all of the biggest things that you've done. And I really liked, you had sort of most imaginary history, but you have all of these sort of other arguments of different things that statements that have been made. What's the, there's sort of a GOP version versus a Democratic version of imaginary history that's happened. Can you share with those sort of, do you think the biggest imaginary history claims that we've had both of the candidates make?
Sure. So we kind of consider this as like our superlatives, kind of like yearbook superlatives of the biggest falsehoods from the campaign, starting from the primaries. And the most imaginary history for the GOP version, we picked Trump's various claims about things that he says happened or things that he says he said, but they didn't. So one of the his most common claims is that he, so he was called a genius by Vladimir Putin. And Putin actually had called him colorful in Russian, and then it kind of got lost in translation. He kind of like, you know, this is like an imaginary like translation of what Putin said. Trump also said that he saw thousands of Muslims in New Jersey celebrate the 9/11 when the towers fell, and he said he watched this on TV, and we looked and looked but could not find this clip, and his campaign couldn't produce one either. So we ranked these in his among his most imaginary history claims.
And what about for Secretary Clinton? Because in terms of her imaginary history, she claimed that she tried to join the Marines on the eve of her marriage in 1975 but was turned down?
Right. That one is very iffy. So, of course, you know, we weren't there in 1975, so we can't say for sure whether it happened. But we gave her two Pinocchios for that, which is like half true or lacks context, because it really doesn't add up for a lot of reasons. You know, she's about to get married to Bill Clinton, a rising star. She just moved to Arkansas, and she said that she tried to join the Marines. And there's like conflicting witness accounts by her friends who said they, you know, kind of remember her saying this or whatnot. And we just couldn't confirm it. And her campaign couldn't produce anything that really confirmed it either. She may have gone to speak to recruiters from the Marines and asked, you know, about whether women can be hired or something like that. But it didn't add up. And among her other imaginary history claims was that Donald Trump opposed the auto bailout in 2009. And this is something we awarded her four Pinocchios to, which is false, because Trump did say in 2008 and 2009 that he supported the auto bailout. So this was one instance where she attributed the wrong quote to him, and we called her out for it because it was an imaginary history, and we awarded her 4 Pinocchios.
All of that said, Michelle, what do you think you guys get the most questions about in terms of people asking for the presidential candidates claims that are made? Do you think do you have your most absurd facts or what you get the most questions about?
Well, in terms of most absurd facts, we had rated Donald Trump's claims, repeated claims that the unemployment rate was 42%.
Did you say 42%?
Right.
Okay.
42%, but it's actually just under 5%. So this is something that readers have asked us, like, what is he talking about? Is this actually true? But usually when he talks about unemployment, he's not using the Bureau of Labor Statistics version, a definition of unemployment, which is the standard accepted worldwide definition. He's using labor force participation rate, which counts people who are retired or are students in like high school full time and not working. So it's people who are not necessarily looking to work or want to work. So he's counting those people as well. And readers have asked us about this. Another thing that readers often ask is about the Clinton email scandal, or controversy, I should say. We gave Clinton 24 Pinocchios, so several different ratings over the course of the campaign for many statements she made regarding her email situation. You know, she said that everything I did with the emails was allowed, and that's just not true. Things she did didn't comply with many government regulations. She said that, you know, the FBI director said that my answers to the public were truthful, but the FBI director didn't say that.
Can I stop you for just a second? Because
sure.
We've got to take a break, but I wanted you to be able to finish that thought. So if you can hang on for just a second, and we'll carry this over the break. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about claims made by politicians during the election. My guest is Michelle Lee. She's a reporter with The Washington Post Fact Checker. Michelle, before I let you go, I wanted to ask you one last question about Hillary Clinton's emails, that controversy. We had news over the weekend from the FBI, from James Comey, saying that the most recent investigation that they're looking into, it seems like they haven't found anything in the emails, reiterating what he said in June. But what has Hillary Clinton said about this? You were going into just before the break things that she said to the FBI. I believe you said you've rated her 24 Pinocchios over the course of the election for different claims she's made back and forth. It's difficult, I guess, to summarize all of those. But what's the gist of what she has said about emails and how truthful have those statements been made?
Sure. You know, the main thing I should point out is her claims about whether she sent or received classified information. And at the beginning, when the email controversy began, she said, you know, I never sent or received classified information. But as the investigation continued, some emails were released by the State Department. It became clear that there may have been some type of classified information, whether retroactively classified or possibly were classified at the time. And she changed her language as more information came out. You know, then it became, I never sent or received anything marked classified, or I never sent anything that was marked classified. So we pointed out that she kept using technical language to possibly, you know, skirt what might be true, what might not be true. And later on, FBI Director James Comey said that there was classified information at the time, possibly not with the same type of markings that she was describing, but there was classified information. So at first we had given her 2 Pinocchios for a half-true claim that later on was upgraded or downgraded, however you see it, to 4 Pinocchios.
Thanks for that. That's Michelle Lee. She's a reporter with The Washington Post, joining us from The Washington Post newsroom, which is going to be a very busy place over the next 48 hours. Michelle, thanks for taking the time to join us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks.
We want to shift now to different claims that have been made about Illinois. And we know also, I want to broaden this conversation, not just to claims but confusion, because we've been talking to you all weekend on social media, on Reddit, on Facebook, and people who, if you wanted to send us claims, you could also email us as well. But if you, mostly what came up was questions about the Safe Roads Amendment. And so we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about that. We're joined now by Matt Dietrich. He's the editor of Reboot Illinois. It's an independent website in partnership with PolitiFact. He's been joining us every Monday leading up the election to fact check candidates and issues during campaign season. And he's online with us from Springfield. Matt, thanks for being back with us on the 21st.
Great to be here, Nyla.
Seems like there's confusion about, first of all, even we've heard it being called the Safe Roads Amendment, the Transportation Lockbox Amendment. We just got a comment from someone on Twitter saying, my cynical side says this is most likely a Madigan idea, therefore not a good idea for the people. What, first of all, what is this amendment about?
This amendment is designed to make it so that every penny that gets paid to go into the road fund gets spent on roads. And mostly that is the 19 cents that you spend that's charged to you on every gallon of gas that you buy. But there's other components of it too, all the fees that drivers pay. All of that goes into the road fund. And Nyla, I should probably, this is one of the places where this gets confusing. When we talk about the Illinois state budget and the General Assembly, when they're fighting over the budget and how to divide the money and everything, what they're talking about is the General Revenue Fund. But in addition to the General Revenue Fund, there are more than 700 special funds, and those range from the road fund, which is one of the big ones, all the way down to things like a special fund for salmon, to protect the salmon in Illinois, restock.
You're not making that up. That is a true
I'm not
statement.
Making that up. They get that special.
I just feel like I have to ask you that. Okay.
Right. Now, what happens commonly, and I'm sure that if you follow Illinois politics, you've heard them talk about fund sweeps. At the end of the year, when an emergency arises and there's not enough money and they need to balance the budget, what they will do is they will go into those special funds that maybe aren't being used that year, and they will sweep that money into the General Revenue Fund to plug the budget gap. Okay? That's what when we talk about fund sweeps, that's
what it
is. And
is this a common thing, Matt? Do other states do this? Is this a common method of budgeting?
I do not know. I have not looked into how other states do budgeting. I would imagine that they probably do it to some extent, but probably not the habitual way that Illinois has done. It's become a standard practice in Illinois almost.
Of essentially revenue collecting.
Because our budget,
right. Our
process has fallen apart over the last, 15 years or however many years you want to put it.
And so speaking of falling apart, our roads are also falling apart, right? Because we know, and you all have looked at the state, 73% of Illinois' roads are in poor or mediocre condition. We have more than 4,200 of the state's 26,000 bridges that are structurally deficient or functionally obsolete. That's a Department of Transportation report. That's what this money is supposed to be going for. That's the point of this amendment, right?
Yes. And the road fund this year will bring in $1.6 billion. And we need, over the next 10 years, we need about $4.3 billion a year to get us up to where we should be with our roads and bridges and transportation infrastructure. So that's the 30-second background on why this comes up. And the reason that the proponents are really adamant about getting this thing passed is they say that over the last 10 years, the state of Illinois has borrowed $6 billion from the road fund in order to prop up the General Revenue Fund. And they want that stopped. Now, this is where it begins to get very tricky, and there are pros and cons to this.
And that's what I wanted to ask, Matt. We had a Reddit user who said, on the surface, this seems like an important and necessary amendment, but what are the potentially hidden pitfalls of this?
Okay. One potentially hidden pitfall is that if you lock this money away, and if there is a huge emergency where the state really, really needs to get all of the money that it has at its fingertips, and it needs to address this emergency, then you wouldn't be able to get to any of this road fund money because it's in the Constitution. If you pass a state statute, if the General Assembly just passes a law and says that this road fund is not eligible for any type of fund sweeps, then if there's an emergency, they can very swiftly pass a law and say it is okay to use the road funds for this. You make that into a constitutional amendment, and for all intents and purposes, that is permanent. It's forever. Look at our pension situation now. The pensions were protected. There's a clause in the state constitution from 1970 that said pension benefits, once granted, shall not be diminished. Well, now we've got $111 billion unfunded pension liability. We're spending 20% of our general revenue fund just trying to prop these pensions up. We can't even do a minor reform to save a few billion dollars a year because we've put it in the state constitution.
So, Matt, would you say that this amendment then essentially comes down to whether or not you trust? It sort of comes down to how you feel about lawmakers in Springfield. Do you trust that they are going to solve all of the other budget problems versus do you think that our roads need to be protected? Is that a fair kind of what it comes down to?
That's part of it. Another part of it is, how important do you think our road infrastructure is in comparison to everything else that state government does? This has been the biggest argument against making this a constitutional amendment. What we're doing, if this passes, and I'm not, you know, I'm just saying this neutrally. I'm not advocating or criticizing here. But what we are doing, when you put something in your constitution, you're really enshrining that as a fundamental, important part of state government that lawmakers cannot touch, okay? What a lot of the critics are saying is, why are we putting roads above funding for services for the developmentally disabled? Why are we putting road funding above higher education funding or school funding or public safety funding? Those are important too. Some people would say they're more important, and they have, you talk about, for example, the developmentally disabled. They don't have lobbyists to go to Springfield and push through a constitutional amendment on their behalf. Some people believe that if this amendment passes, it's proof that if you've got the power and the money and the lobbying muscle to ram this through the General Assembly, that you can make your own pet project sacred in Illinois and untouchable by the governor or the General Assembly.
Matt Dietrich is with us. He's the editor of Reboot Illinois. He's been working with PolitiFact Illinois as well on claims. I want to bring someone else into this conversation. Amanda Vinicky is a State House Bureau Chief for Illinois Public Radio. We're going to be talking with Amanda a lot over the next 48 hours. Amanda, let me just bring you in. As we've been talking about the Safe Roads Amendment, I want to get to a couple other issues on the ballot. We've got about 5 minutes left for this conversation, but I want to ask you about the final U.S. Senate debate Friday night between Representative Tammy Duckworth, Democrat, her Republican incumbent opponent Mark Kirk. What are the biggest issues that are being raised in the Senate race?
You know, the debate itself seems largely like a retread of what we'd heard before, where you have Republican Kirk really trying to cast himself as a moderate to separate himself from Donald Trump, including going as far as to say that he is a Republican who won't, quote, sell their soul to the party to show his allegiance. He says that Trump is not best for the country. And then you had Duckworth likewise trying to cast herself as the best choice on really some of the same issues. They disagree some on immigration, on Syrian refugees, but they share a similar view when it comes to, for example, gun control. So there was that. What really has been the storyline lately was following the last debate in Springfield just a couple of weeks ago, was when Mark Kirk made a comment that many people, pretty much everybody, saw as offensive. Some saw as racist when he said of Duckworth and her family's heritage in the military, that, quote, "I forgot your family had come from Thailand to serve George Washington." And Kirk did use his opportunity at that debate Friday to right off the bat apologize and say it was a mistake. He says that he's too quick to turn a phrase. Duckworth says she accepts that apology, but she did go on to list other times when Kirk may have been too quick to turn a phrase to say that he is not performing the job.
That's sort of, I think, the biggest race that we're looking at, Illinois. The U.S. Senate seat's got national attention because of the possibility of the Democrats winning that seat from Republicans. Let's move to state house races. Amanda, what races are you looking at, keeping kind of the closest eye on over the next 24 hours within local state house races?
What we're really concerned about is the overall map. And so when you move back from the individual races itself, it's what do they mean for control of the General Assembly and particularly control of the Illinois House. Predictions are that it would be very tough for Democrats to lose their super majority in the Senate, though possible, but no matter what, they won't lose their majority. And somewhat similar in the Illinois House, where really all that you have to have is just one seat lost by Democrats, and then the Democrats in the House won't have a supermajority anymore that allows them to override a veto. So you're looking at the big numbers game. But there are, of course, some races that have a greater likelihood than others. I'd say some of the top ones are where you have a race in Chicago with incumbent Representative Republican Mike McAuliffe, where you've just seen the GOP pour top dollar into that race because he is the only Republican in Chicago. And then I'd say kind of one of the other big telltales would be the opposite end of the state. If you look down in southern Illinois, where Republicans are doing all they can to knock out a long-term incumbent Democrat, that is John Bradley. He is a key top leader in the Illinois House and therefore a lieutenant of House Speaker Michael Madigan's. And so those are both of the races that I think would be seen by the parties themselves as a big loss. You probably have just over a dozen or so other races that are competitive, both in the House and in the Senate and the rest of the state, including in the suburbs and a handful in central Illinois.
I should add, we did have a comment on Reddit for someone who was asking, pointing out how many races were unopposed. And we had a conversation about that last week, so we'll tweet out that conversation. For those of you who are looking at the ballot wondering why you don't have very many choices, we did talk about that earlier on the program last week. That said, Amanda, we've got about a minute left, and I just want to ask how much you think this election, in general, these local races are simply proxy elections for House Speaker Madigan versus Republican Governor Bruce Rauter.
It's hard to say what voters will do. Often you have people that have allegiances to their local representative, particularly, or senator, particularly when they are incumbents. These are people that they know as individuals. So it may be tough to see them as Rauter or as Madigan. But particularly on the Republican side, you have seen them attempt to do that as much as possible, to say that a vote for a Democrat in the House or is a vote for the Speaker. So I think we see it as a proxy war because of who's funding these campaigns and how much of that money has come from Rauter himself, literally, and then from Labor and the Democratic Party leadership on that side. So yes, it is a proxy war. And again, because of how these votes turn out and what that will mean for the balance of power, that's what it's going to end up largely being when all is said and done.
Matt, wanted to ask you to chime in as well in terms of, you think what turnout will look like among all of these races, how much you think the presidential race will affect turnout, how much of it is a reflection of how people are feeling about the state as well?
Well, I think that we're going to have probably the highest turnout that we've had maybe since 1992.
Wow.
And that's just based on the fact that we had record high turnout for the primary. We had 47%. That's very, very, very high.
And we're seeing early voting totals really high, right? Matt, I know in Sangamon County, some record totals in Sangamon. Are we seeing that throughout the state also then?
That is, I believe so. And I think that that's been driven a lot by Cook County
number,
and Chicago.
So hard to say. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Right. So as Amanda was saying, hard to say statewide. We're hearing from individual clerks as well who were saying that. So we will be checking in on that tomorrow. Amanda, you're going to be back with us tomorrow. I want to thank Matt Dietrich, who's also been with us this entire time preparing us on Truth and Lies for Elections. We've got all of that stuff we've tweeted out as well. So if you followed 21st Show, I want to thank Matt Dietrich, editor of Reboot Illinois, working with PolitiFact Illinois. Amanda Vinicky, IPR State House Bureau Chief, will be hearing from her as well. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned. Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boudou. On Friday's program, we were talking about your rights as a voter at the polls, and we've heard feedback from our listeners on this segment and wanted to follow up, especially for those of you who are headed to the polls tomorrow. On the program, we played a voicemail from Sam, a former Champaign resident who felt discriminated against when she went to vote in 2008 in Savoy and was the only person of color at the polling place.
When I got up to the table to get my name crossed off the list and get my ballot, I was definitely approached by one woman who was sitting at the desk in her McCain Palin t-shirt, and she asked me for my ID. And the young man, who is also an election judge sitting next to her, said, "You see, she's voted before. She's not required to show it." And, of course, I was given my ballot and I voted. The whole experience definitely made me feel really nervous whenever I go vote, even though I know it's my right.
We played that on Friday's program. Champaign County Clerk Gordy Holton asked to respond to the story, and so did our other guest, McLean County Clerk Kathy Michael.
I am hesitant to believe the veracity of that lady's story. You know, we're fortunate in Central Illinois, just with some great people and raised right. And I'm not saying that that never happens. It's never happened with us.
That was McLean County Clerk Kathy Michael on the program on Friday. Here's Champaign County Clerk Gordy Holton.
Not only are election judges not allowed to wear T-shirts showing which candidates they support, voters are not, poll watchers are not. So that makes me sort of wonder about the veracity of the entire story. If she was viewed suspiciously in her polling place, I'm obviously terribly sorry she felt that way, but I'm wondering how much embellishment there is.
As Champaign County Clerk Gordy Holton, he went on to explain the only two instances in which a person would be required to show a photo ID. That's if you're a first-time voter who's registered to vote by mail and the county clerk's office wasn't able to verify any of the ID information against the Secretary of State's database, or if the signature you provided on the ballot doesn't match the one you provided when you registered. We reached out to both Champaign County GOP and Democrats to have them weigh on the issue. They both agreed with the clerks that it's unlikely an election judge would have been able to get away with wearing a campaign shirt inside a polling place. The Champaign County GOP wrote in an email that our system is designed that both parties are involved to provide checks and balances to keep our elections fair. You had a caller that had a chip on their shoulder, not a caller with a valid issue. As to the issue of showing a photo ID, the chair of the Champaign County Democrats Central Committee told us via phone this morning that they have heard complaints from people in previous election years about being asked to show ID in instances where they should not have been required to do so. They said they'd also heard from people of color who felt judges were, quote, persnickety about the way they had signed their ballots, but that those issues they feel have been successfully addressed thanks to attorneys who've worked with them to address issues of voter suppression. Obviously, this is one person's recount of what happened at her polling places. We did try to do some reporting to find out if an official complaint had been filed. It hadn't. The county Democrats said they weren't able to go back and verify that a complaint was filed in time before we went to air. But because we'd heard from listeners who called and posted online expressing surprise at the response from officials, raising questions about what the process should be when a voter has a complaint, we wanted to bring back Ami Gandhi. She's a lawyer with the nonpartisan Chicago Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. Ami, welcome back to The 21st. Thanks for coming back to talk to us about this.
Thank you so much for having me.
First, a story. I have to ask you, you're a lawyer. You all have a hotline that people call in to report stories. You've had that for years. What do you think of this particular story?
We all need to be open to voter stories, like the woman who called and shared her story with your show. We need to have an exchange with voters, talk to them about their voting experience and the details of what happened. And if we have questions about those details, or even if we're doubtful of some of the details, what we need to do is open up the lines of communication and not accuse the voter of fabricating a story or bringing up invalid issues or rush to judgment when we haven't had the communication with the voter yet. Now, we receive numerous phone calls to our nonpartisan 866 Our Vote hotline in advance of the elections and on election day. And we are accustomed to going back and forth with the voter about their memory, about the details of their experience. Who knows, the person the voter encountered in a past election might have been a partisan poll watcher whom the election judges should have removed. Not all voters have the same familiarity and recollection of all of the personnel and individuals and circumstances inside the polling place. Right, every election has had electioneering. Every election has had improperly trained election judges or discrimination or intimidation at the polls. Now, most election judges are working really hard during an extremely long workday, are trying to follow the rules. But if there are circumstances when an election judge isn't doing what they're supposed to be doing, we all should be working together, advocates, county clerks, and voters, to resolve those issues as soon as they come up. And we can only do that if we keep the lines of communication open.
I mean, I want to ask you something, because you said electioneering, and I think a lot of people might not even know. What does that mean?
We are not permitted inside the polling place to promote or oppose a candidate or a party. That rule applies to us voters. It applies to poll watchers. It applies to election judges and anyone else who's inside the polling place or within 100 feet of the door to the room where the polling place is situated. And that's an important right for all of us to keep in mind as voters. We have the right to vote freely without pressure about who we should vote for or against. And any time that right is not being respected, any time there are leaflets or T-shirts or buttons or comments being made about certain candidates or pressuring us to vote one way or another, we here at Chicago Lawyers Committee encourage voters to tell their election judge, to call their county clerk's office and report that, to call our hotline 866-OUR-VOTE so that we can help to prevent that problem in the future. If an election judge is tolerating something or is engaging in conduct that they shouldn't, they should immediately be removed so that the election can be conducted in a fair manner.
And does that removal happen immediately? Does it happen? Because I think it's a tough thing, right? And on Friday, we did ask Champaign County Clerk Gordy Holton about this, and he said, yes, there have been election judges who have been removed. How does that process work? If you make a complaint, is someone removed that day or immediately? How long does that normally take?
We definitely respect that there are so many moving parts that the county clerks and election officials are juggling on the day of. And whether an election judge should be removed immediately, of course, should depend on the common sense calculus of how severe the issue was, whether some additional training or supervision could help to nip that situation in the bud. Is it a matter of a county clerk or another supervisor talking to that election judge and explaining the rules and being proactive and constructive in the face of a voting barrier? If that's possible, that certainly could be a solution, especially in this election season when we're seeing very long lines and we need as many great trained personnel as possible at the polls. However, if it is an instance of an election judge who is behaving in a discriminatory manner, who is treating people differently based on their race or language ability or perceived national origin or other characteristics, that's flat out wrong and that shouldn't be tolerated. And election judges whose conduct rises to that level should be removed immediately. Many times it is a matter of an election judge needing extra reminders and training about what is and is not allowed in the polling place. And we really appreciate being able to work with county clerks and election officials to do problem solving, to figure out what is the best solution in that moment so that as many voters can still be served in the polling place as possible.
I mean, how much do we know of photo ID? I don't know if photo ID discrimination is the appropriate term, but is this a common complaint when people are calling your hotline saying, I was asked to provide a photo ID, which, just to be clear, is not a requirement by Illinois law for voters?
Yes, time and time again, we frequently hear from Illinois voters who call our hotline that they were improperly requested ID during voting. And that has continued during this early voting season, even though ID is no longer required in Illinois for early voting, and certainly not on the day of, on election day either. Yet people continue to be asked for ID at the polls improperly. And we've received multiple stories and complaints from voters who feel that they were singled out and asked for ID because of their race, because of their national origin, or their perceived background, and we're definitely very concerned about that. There have been numerous situations where a mixed race couple registered at the same time, perhaps in the process of getting a driver's license when they moved, or in one situation we heard about a mixed race couple registered to vote together at the same gay pride festival. And yet when it came time for those couples to go to the polls, they noticed that the black partner in the couple was asked for ID when the white partner in the couple who registered at the same time and through the same manner was not asked for an ID. And that's happened in multiple places throughout Illinois, including in Champaign County.
So you have received calls from people in Champaign County or other parts of central Illinois contacting you all. Again, it's a nonpartisan hotline to complain about racial discrimination at the polls.
Yes, we have. We have received those complaints. Sometimes it's because of how voters are treated by election judges. Sometimes it's because of how voters are treated by officials who are conducting voter registration, or by partisan poll watchers, or by fellow voters in the polling place. So the context of discrimination and disenfranchisement at the polls is not solely because of misconduct by election judges. We certainly don't want to paint that picture. Many election judges are hardworking, are trying to follow the rules, are trying to learn the most recent updates to the Illinois election law. However, it's important that we all work together and keep the lines of communication open so that when there are election judges who are breaking the rules or who need some additional training or supervision from the county clerk's office, we know who those individuals are, how to communicate with them so that we can correct the situation as soon as possible. You know, this is the day before election day. This is the perfect time for voters to be sharing stories so that we can address these issues in time for tomorrow's huge surge of voters that we expect. And so this is the time we want voters to feel comfortable sharing their stories, sharing their questions, and not to make voters feel overly scrutinized or accuse them of fabricating information or bringing up invalid issues if we haven't yet had a chance to have a back and forth conversation with those voters.
And I want to say, Ami, part of the reason why we wanted to do this segment was because we had not just callers, but people on social media who said they were troubled by the outright dismissal both clerks had of this story. And as a nonpartisan voting rights attorney, what should the response be of clerks to any report? What should the how should a voting board respond to a complaint that's made?
Election officials and all of us should be open to voter stories and concerns, especially at a time like this, especially because we can't solve many of these problems going into election day. I myself received calls from community leaders in Champaign and members of the African American community in Champaign County over the weekend. Chicago Lawyers Committee is hearing from people who are very concerned about election issues and barriers at the polls in Champaign County. And many of those issues are solvable. If there are overcrowded polls, if there are long lines, if people do feel like they've been treated differently because of their race, these are issues that we hope we can address and resolve with the county officials. But we can only do that if the lines of communication are open. And we really hope that county officials and election officials and election judges going forward take these stories seriously, take these complaints seriously, and be open for a back and forth conversation with voters about what's happening and what we can do next to solve the issue.
That said, all of that said, as a voter going to the polls tomorrow, so everybody's on the same page, whether you're a hardworking election judge who are volunteers, we should add, a poll watcher, a person who's a voter going to the polls, what's sort of the basic things you need to know as your rights as a voter in Illinois tomorrow?
In Illinois, people generally do not need ID in order to vote. The exception to that is primarily if a person is registering for the first time, for example, using grace period registration today or using election day registration tomorrow. Those are really incredible voter access tools that have made a huge difference for historically disenfranchised communities to be able to have a voice on election day, even if they hadn't registered before, as long as they're eligible. And so it's important for everyone to know it's not too late to register. You can still register today or tomorrow. In that case, you should bring two IDs with you. For example, it could be a driver's license or a state ID, along with a credit card or a piece of mail. And if people are already correctly registered, which they can check that online with the Illinois State Board of Elections or their appropriate county clerk's office, depending on which county they live in. If they check that they're registered correctly, then they do not need an ID to vote. And if anyone has questions about whether you are registered correctly, what you do need to bring to the polls, where you can vote, when you can vote, any other questions, please call us at 866-OUR-VOTE, and we would be happy to answer your questions today or tomorrow, anytime.
That's Ami Gandhi. I want to thank her for joining us. Again, she's with the Nonpartisan Chicago Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. Ami, we're going to check in with you tomorrow for a few minutes to see how everything is going, how calls to that hotline are going to be. But thanks so much for taking the time to explain all of that for us today.
Thank you so much.
We've got lots of resources on our website for you looking for information. As we talked about the Safe Roads Amendment, other things, head to 21stshow.org if you're looking for more resources before you vote tomorrow. Stay tuned. Our election coverage is going to continue on your station throughout this day for tomorrow's program and into the evening tomorrow as well. You'll be hearing all of these voices for the next 48 hours. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to vote tomorrow.